Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar series, where great professors teach you. My name is Tom Steckschulte, and I'll be your host. Today, we begin a course entitled Evolutionary Psychology Part 1, The Science of Human Nature. Your professor will be Alan D. McNeil. Alan McNeil earned a B.S. in biology in 1974 and an M.A. in science education from Cornell in 1977. He's taught the support course Introductory Biology at Cornell University since 1976. As a senior lecturer in the Learning Strategies Center at Cornell, McNeil works with students taking both majors and non-majors introductory biology. In addition, he organizes and carries out in-service training for teaching assistants in biology and related fields. Alan also teaches evolution for the Cornell Summer Session and has taught the Introductory Evolution course for non-majors at Cornell. He has served as a faculty fellow at Ecology House and as an honorary member and faculty advisor for the Cornell chapter of the Golden Key International Honor Society. He has served on numerous advisory committees and editorial boards at Cornell and in the Ithaca community. Along with his many teaching assignments, Alan has appeared in a number of off-Broadway plays and in other acting venues. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites and a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students. And now, we begin Evolutionary Psychology, Part 1, The Science of Human Nature, Lecture 1. Evolutionary Psychology, A Conceptual History.
People are curious about people. We've always been fascinated by what people do and why we do it. Most people are compulsive people watchers, beginning in very early infancy and lasting the rest of our lives. We are endlessly attracted to other people, constantly watching them and trying to figure them out. And not just other people. We carefully observe our own behavior, interpreting and anticipating our own actions as avidly as those of the people around us. This curiosity about each other and ourselves is a trait we share with other social animals, especially primates. As we will see, this exaggerated curiosity is not accidental, nor is it necessarily bad. On the contrary, it is one of the central reasons for our success as individuals and as a species. Curiosity may have killed the cat, but it has more than once saved the lives of our evolutionary ancestors. This lecture series is about the reasons why we are so curious about each other and what we have learned so far as the result of satisfying that curiosity. The subject of the science of evolutionary psychology is us, and its primary goal is to understand what we do and why we do it. To put it in formal terms, evolutionary psychology is the scientific study of human behavior from an evolutionary perspective. Evolutionary psychologists observe people very carefully, either directly or by analyzing indirect information such as demographic data. Our work sometimes takes us out into the field, observing people in their natural habitat, in much the same way that an ornithologist might observe the behavior of some exotic bird. Some evolutionary psychologists also conduct carefully controlled laboratory experiments, although their laboratory might be something as simple as a rickety bridge across a gorge on a college campus. In all cases, the intent is to observe people in the same way that animal behaviorists observe members of other species, without biases or preconceptions about what ought to be happening. Evolutionary psychologists also ask people what they're doing and why they're doing it, although, as we will see, such self-reporting is often unreliable. This isn't necessarily bad. Even such unreliability can tell us something interesting about human motivations and our capacity, almost unlimited, for self-deception. Evolutionary psychology is, of course, a branch of psychology, one of the newest branches of one of the oldest of human disciplines. As the name implies, it has its roots in Charles Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. Darwin's theory gives us a theoretical perspective that makes it possible to ask questions about animal behavior that have not been asked in a systematic way before. It also provides a very practical set of experimental and observational techniques that allow us to make predictions about human behavior in specific contexts. What evolutionary psychology does not do is to recycle old ideas about human nature, except insofar as such ideas may coincidentally be based on the unbiased observations of human behavior. Evolutionary psychology is most emphatically not social Darwinism, neither in its origins nor in its conclusions. Indeed, as we go along, you may be surprised at some of the concepts that have come from the scientific study of human behavior from an evolutionary perspective. As we will see, this is not your grandfather's social science, although, in some intriguing ways, it just might be your grandmother's. Again, evolutionary psychology is about what we do and why we do it. Psychologists have historically focused on one of these two subjects, often to the exclusion of the other. That is, psychologists have often either focused on external behavior or its internal motivation, but not both. Behavior is what an organism does. Motivation is why an organism does it. Although this division appears simple, it encapsulates a dichotomy that has split psychology into two often hostile camps for over a century. Essentially, this division is between experimental psychologists who believe that only observable phenomena can be studied using scientific methods, and theoretical psychologists who believe that it is not only possible to infer and thereby study internal motivations and mental states, that is, what we could call the mind, but that such internal states are the ultimate causes of human behavior. As we will see, this division is often mirrored in evolutionary biology. On one side are the field and laboratory scientists who conduct carefully controlled observations and experiments, testing relatively limited hypotheses. On the other are theoreticians who use mathematical and computer models to formulate synthetic theories that are not always amenable to direct empirical testing. Does this mean that these divisions are therefore unbridgeable? If history is any guide, the answer is no. In The Origin of Species, Darwin presented a synthetic theory of evolution, in which field and laboratory observations are used as a foundation for inferring an overarching explanation of the causes and consequences of what Darwin called descent with modification, his word for evolution. Darwin not only presented mountains of evidence showing that evolution had happened, he also provided a testable explanation of the mechanisms that had caused it, an explanation based solely on naturalistic processes. Evolutionary psychology, like evolutionary theory in general, aims for a synthetic theory that includes both rigorous and unbiased observations of human behavior, including an examination of the contexts within which behaviors occur, and an explanation of the underlying causes of those behaviors from the perspective of evolutionary biology. As such, it constitutes what may be the first genuinely unified theory of human behavior, one that is both grounded in direct observation and yet is applicable to the many of the most abstract levels of human cognition. Such things as epistemology, ethics, and even aesthetics. Like all of the natural sciences, evolutionary psychology is ultimately an empirical science. That is, it is ultimately based on observations of the world, and is therefore about description. Like all of the empirical sciences, evolutionary psychology must accept the world the way that it is, rather than the way we would like it to be. Prescribing the world the way we would like it to be is the domain of ethics, not science. We will talk about ethics a little bit, but not until our exploration of the science of evolutionary psychology is almost finished. Many of the explanatory concepts developed by evolutionary psychologists have come from relatively simple observations of people in partially or fully controlled environments. The same kinds of observations made by social psychologists and sociologists, although from a somewhat different perspective. Other concepts have come from answers to questions posed during interviews or on questionnaires. Still others have come from an analysis of census data or demographic data, which is sometimes collected for other purposes. Some explanatory concepts in evolutionary psychology are derived from general evolutionary theory, that is, from the formal theories of evolutionary biology and not from specific cases. For example, much of what evolutionary biologists have learned about sexual behavior and mating has come from observations that were stimulated by theoretical analyses of the effects of differing amounts of parental investment in offspring. As has often been the case, such abstract theories have suggested empirical tests, which has yielded many interesting and often surprising observations and inferences, which have in turn suggested new theoretical analyses. Finally, some explanatory concepts in evolutionary psychology have come from studies of other non-human animals. Now, this strikes some people, and especially some social scientists and humanists, as odd, and perhaps leading to invalid conclusions. After all, people are very different from other animals in many respects. While this is true, it ignores a central concept of the natural sciences, that is, similar causes produce similar effects. In other words, comparative studies of the behavior of other animals in particular contexts can provide remarkable insight into the causes of such behavior. And if such causes and contexts also apply to human behavior, then we may infer that similar causes and contexts can indeed be correlated with similar effects, even in our own behavior. What does this allow us to do? Well, when it works, it allows us to predict the future. This is the underlying goal of all scientific investigation, to understand enough about the causes of natural phenomena to be able to predict, that is, to anticipate their effects. And, of course, to satisfy curiosity, because that is why we are so curious in the first place. Curiosity, like so many other human and primate behavioral traits, has adaptive value, or, as restated the way an evolutionary biologist would state it, individuals who are curious about the behaviors and motivations of others survive and reproduce more often than those who are less curious. Evolutionary psychology as a science is very new compared with many of the other natural sciences. However, trying to figure out the patterns of human behavior and the reasons for those behaviors predates the origins of civilization. There are records from Egyptian papyrus scrolls that indicate that almost 4,000 years ago, people were thinking about the causes of such psychological conditions as clinical depression. The Dead Sea Scrolls, which are dated to about 100 years B.C., include a description of two different temperaments in humans, an early attempt to find a pattern and the motivations of human behavior. And in China, psychological tests have been part of civil service examinations for centuries. The term psychology was first used in its modern sense in 1590 by the German philosopher Rudolf Goclenius, who based it on the Greek word psyche, meaning soul or spirit. From this viewpoint, psychology means knowledge or understanding of the human soul or spirit. European philosophers and theologians had speculated for millennia on the existence and properties of this soul. But in 1672, Thomas Willis asserted that the soul is a function of the human brain, rather than the heart or some immaterial entity. Psychology as a science can be dated to 1879, when Wilhelm Wundt founded a laboratory in Leipzig, Germany, to study human behavior and mental states. In 1890, the American educator and psychologist William James published the first edition of his textbook, Principles of Psychology. In it, James, like Wundt, asserted that human behavior could be analyzed using the methods of the other sciences, and that this is possible because human psychology is a natural phenomenon, rather than something supernatural like souls or spirits. Inspired at least in part by James's work, American psychologists formed the American Psychological Association in 1892, basing its practices and philosophy on the experimental approach pioneered by Wundt and James. However, the experimental approach favored by many American psychologists was soon overshadowed by the work of Sigmund Freud, an Austrian physician originally trained in medical neurology. Freud began his professional career using hypnotism to attempt to treat patients with psychological ailments, but moved on to propose a comprehensive theory to explain the underlying causes of human behavior. Freud's theory of psychoanalysis was based on a unifying idea that almost all of human behavior was ultimately motivated by unconscious drives such as hunger, thirst, fear, and especially sex. Since, in Freud's theory, such drives are unconscious and exist within the mind of the individual, they cannot be observed directly at all. Instead, the existence of these drives can only be inferred based on the behavior of the individual whose actions they are supposedly motivating. Furthermore, Freud and many of his followers did not generally attempt to determine if his theories about drives and their implications were supported by observable experimental evidence. During the first half of the 20th century, Freud's theories about the causes of human behaviors dominated the science of psychology in Europe. But in America, a very different tradition developed, called behaviorism. The founders of this tradition rejected Freud's theories about motivation and unconscious minds, and focused instead solely on behaviors, what animals, including people, do, rather than speculating on why they do it. Behaviorists such as Edward Thorndike, John B. Watson, and especially B.F. Skinner argued that a purely empirical science of behavior could be developed that could be used to predict and even to shape animal and human behavior without speculating at all about motivations. However, after a half century of experimental psychology focused almost exclusively on behavior, it became increasingly obvious that a full understanding of animal and especially human behavior required a theory of mind. That is, it required some theoretical model of how the nervous system produces behaviors and why specific behaviors are correlated with specific contexts. This revolution in psychology took hold in four different but related disciplines: in linguistics and computer sciences, in neurobiology, and in the study of animal behavior from an evolutionary perspective. In linguistics, Noam Chomsky developed a theory of natural language which had, at its base, the idea that human language has a universal deep structure, and that the capacity to learn language is therefore innate. All humans are born with the capacity to learn language without having to be directly taught. In computer sciences, the development of information processing programs required a computational architecture that included something like a mind, that is, a central processor that integrated inputs, what we might call sensations, with outputs, what we might call behaviors. In neurobiology, investigations of the structure and function of the sensory, nervous, and motor systems of animals, including humans, pointed to a functional architecture that both facilitated behavior and constrained it within patterns set by the cellular architecture of the nervous system. And, in the study of animal behavior, empirical studies of how animals learned showed that the pure behaviorism of the American school did not explain why different species of animals, and indeed different sexes and individuals within a species, exhibited different behaviors in different ecological and evolutionary contexts. Two new disciplines within the science of psychology have grown out of these four traditions: cognitive psychology and evolutionary psychology. Both of these new disciplines are grounded in the use of the scientific method. They depend upon observations of behavior to infer theories of motivation, and generally reject introspection as a way of determining why an organism does what it does. And, unlike behaviorism, both disciplines also explicitly infer the existence of internal mental states. Ultimately, I believe that the disciplines of cognitive psychology and evolutionary psychology will eventually merge into a synthetic discipline in which behavior and motivation are both explained with reference to the underlying architecture of the nervous system within which the mind resides, and which is ultimately shaped by the evolutionary history of our nervous systems. This series of lectures is a first look at this evolving synthesis and at the evidence upon which it is based. We will begin this lecture series with a brief overview of the basic principles of evolutionary biology and how they are applied to the study of animal and human behavior. As we will see, this will require us to talk about all of those subjects one is supposed to avoid in polite company: politics, sex, religion, violence, and most of all, the contents of our minds. Along the way, we will develop a model of what evolutionary psychologists call the adapted mind. That is, the human mind that has been shaped by our evolutionary past. And we will see how this model fundamentally undermines the blank slate model of the mind that has dominated much of the social sciences for the past century. Then, we will consider how evolutionary psychologists view those behaviors as performed by individuals or small, usually related, family-sized groups. We will consider the evolutionary aspects of daily life, such as finding and preparing food, clothing, and shelter, treating the sick and injured, and organizing family life, small groups, and communities. We will learn how evolutionary biologists think about sex and how it has shaped our behavior, for good and for ill, of course. Along the way, we will answer the question, are we monogamous? And discover that the answer to this question is both more obvious and more complicated than most of us think. We will consider what characteristics we find attractive in a potential mate, and learn that there are at least three ways of being in love with very different causes and consequences, and we will learn how understanding the dynamics of mating and family life among other species can shed light on our own families and the changes that our families are currently going through. As we will see, the idea of evolution fundamentally alters, and in some cases, directly contradicts, some of our most cherished ideas about who we are, where we come from, why we do the things we do, and where we might be going. It does this by asking a deceptively simple question: how do we know what we know? And then presenting a deceptively simple answer: by observing the world, and especially the people around us. In this lecture series, we will pursue this idea, the idea of observation as the basis of an understanding of our behavior, as relentlessly as Captain Ahab pursued Moby Dick. But fear not, sailors. If we have courage and a light heart, once we have harpooned our whale and rocketed through our intellectual Nantucket sleigh ride, Moby Dick will not drag us down into the depths. Indeed, if we are lucky, and I believe we are, we will find ourselves adrift in the sunlight on an endless sea of possibilities. We will, to paraphrase Henry David Thoreau, put some things behind. We'll pass an invisible boundary. New, universal, and more liberal laws will begin to establish themselves around and within us, or the old laws be expanded and interpreted in our favor in a more liberal sense, and the laws of the universe will appear less complex, and solitude will not be solitude, nor poverty, poverty, nor weakness, weakness. So, grab the gunwales, mates, and hang on. There she blows. In the next lecture in this series, we'll take a look at more of what I mentioned earlier, that is, investigating the unmentionable. In particular, we will take a look at a device that seems to exist in our mind, a thing that evolutionary psychologists call an agency detector. And we will apply our understanding of that agency detector to an understanding of how people talk about politics, violence, sex, and all the things that we find fascinating, that we endlessly talk about when we're together with our friends in a social situation, but which we certainly shouldn't mention in polite company.
This ends Lecture 1.